our guest today is really fun because, well, it's ironically fun.
Yeah.
Because she is an author. Her name is Kate Winkler Dawson. And she wrote a book called Death in the Air, which does not sound fun. But,
oh my God, on the subject of airplanes. I mean, yeah, air, I was just
this
saying.
This is about the time I was on a plane where music started and I killed everyone. Yeah. Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the great London smog, and the strangling of a city.
Ooh. Mm.
So here's what is great about the book. First of all, the cover is amazing, and you should just take a look at that because they found a picture of a woman, a black and white photo from that time when there was a smog in London, and she has this beautiful scarf wrapped around her mouth, and she has this look. It's very arresting, and it's so elegant, but you know that she's walking through like pea soup in the city because it's so gross. Anyway, the author conflates or compares the response at the same time in London. There was a serial killer on the loose and there was a smog. The smog was killing thousands of people by, you know, different ailments that it can create in your
pollution.
Lungs and things. Yeah. And the serial killer, of course, is scary, but was not killing thousands of people. And so it speaks to the way that humans have fear and yes. why they are scared of certain things, but not other things that are more like yes. pressing, including now with the climate change.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You just blew my mind with that.
Yeah.
That is a really good
comparison. Yeah. And we all do it. I'm way more interested to read about the guy in Vegas than I am to read about the ice caps melting.
Yeah. And
you
people
know.
Will march outside of Planned Parenthood clinic. Meanwhile, there are tons of deaths happening from
climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a hundred other things that
yeah.
are, you know.
Right. That we prefer to hear and read and educate ourselves about things that are
right.
sexy in that way, you know,
yes.
sort of like dangerous.
Well, and also that are we have some sort of control over.
That's
some
what
sort
I said.
Of,
we feel like if we catch
yes.
the boogeyman,
yep.
then it's all going to be fine.
Yep,
I said that to her in the interview.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It really does. Because,
I mean,
even
thing.
Though I have yet to read the book and
yeah.
it sounds so good and I can't wait to, but that's kind of where my mind goes with that and why we love Law and Order, Special Victims Unit, and stuff like that, because we want closure and it's easier to have closure with one person than
yeah.
a concept or an idea.
Exactly.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And she's a fascinating writer, really does a good job of putting you into that time. And
what time was this?
So this was, let me look at the exact year because I really don't even remember. I think it was 1952.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the killer is pictured here and
yeah.
you sense that he's evil?
No, he's worse.
He looks normal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the most evil ones are like that. Like
yeah.
Ted Bundy.
And it's just a really great read, and she's cool because she used to be a journalist, and she reported on this case back in the day, the Gary Condit case. Again, people thought he was a congressman. People thought he killed his intern Chandra Levy. Do you remember that?
Oh, I remember.
You're
her
pretty
name,
young,
but I don't remember his.
She was murdered, and she was having an affair with him,
God.
And she people thought he did it.
Did
and
he?
No,
she,
it was a serial
it?
Killer. Yeah.
And that just happened to overlap. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And she covered that, so I asked her about that case as well, because that's just interesting. But anyway, yeah. I mean, it really tells you a lot about the brain and
mm-hmm.
why we're drawn to certain stories and what's interesting. But she's a great person to talk to if you're into true crime, because she has a lot of experience.
I know the brain candy brainiacs are.
I know.
Yep.
So I think they'll really like this interview because we touch upon those things and talk about my penitentiary pals that I write
yes.
to and stuff like that. But anyway, I welcome Kate to the show, and I hope you guys check out her book, Death in the Air, The True Story of a Serial Killer, The Great London Smog, and The Strangling of a City. It was such a fascinating book. Congratulations. How do you feel?
Thank you. It's been great. I mean,
yeah.
it's 3 years in the making, and it's exhausting, but it's wonderful. I know, right?
Are you
seems like
so
a long
over
time.
It?
As long as it seems, it's even longer, I promise you. I'm not over it, but I'm, you know, reaching capacity. I think my love bucket is filled for for death.
Yeah, because you have to research it, then you got to write the dang thing, and then you got to talk about it to all the clowns like me who, you know, want to know more. But, I mean, it's a real accomplishment, so you should be proud. Okay, so I didn't even know about the fog situation. I mean, I knew about the apparel brand that was called London Fog, and that was about it. And so, you know, it kind of speaks to the book's point that this didn't get the kind of attention that it deserved.
Right.
Okay, so let's start there. Why the heck didn't people care about this disgusting situation and dangerous?
I think a couple of things. It's the same reason why we're not completely horrified in America of the state of our air right now, which is not good. So London, 1952, is post-war, 4 years after the war, World War II. And it's just a nation that's literally shell-shocked. I mean, there are still buildings in ruin. The government's bankrupt. Coal is just a part of life of being a Londoner. It's the most populated city in the world at the time. It's the most industrialized. It's a compact. People are living on top of each other. There's a lot of poverty. And, you know, these fogs are just well known. I mean, it's part of life in London. And dirty, nasty, yellow fogs just came and gone. And the difference was this one didn't go for 5 days. And that's what caused the problem. And even then, it didn't occur to people that this was the bad fog until the government started releasing the number of people who died. And then it sort of became apparent. But even then, you know, it was, I think it was a situation where people just said, well, let's just, you know, stiff upper lip and move on, which is a little horrifying. But I think it was just, you know, even now, a lot of people in London I've spoken to have no idea, never heard of it, unless you've seen The Crown. And then you've heard of it. So almost every woman over 45 I've met has heard of it. But they've all seen The Crown.
So you're doing research and you're thinking this would be a cool story for a book. And then you start coming across these other headlines about something else that was killing people at the time. And how, I know it's sort of ghastly, but how excited were you to be like, oh, dang, we can combine these situations, these stories into one yeah. narrative.
I used a word a lot stronger than dang, I think.
Really? Because that's exciting.
It was. And I am a huge true crime fan. I was a TV producer for years and I report on crime. It's just my wheelhouse. I love it. And I grew up with a father who was a criminal defense attorney. So I wasn't looking for a serial killer who stashed bodies under floorboards and, you know, in behind kitchen walls and in the garden. But when I was trying to find information on the fog in the newspapers, I couldn't get away from this beast of Rillington Place and House of Horrors. And so, I just started realizing there was this connection, and I found a letter that his wife had written about the fog and how they were kind of smushed together and they couldn't, you know, they were both sick from the fog. And so I just realized that these stories could work really well in parallel with each other. And then they eventually converge in the media because honestly, the media could care less at that point about the fog. And they were much more concerned about this serial killer who was on the loose. And so was the media and so were the politicians also.
Yeah. And I mean, really that just sort of reflects the public's interest, which is the same now. We do the exactly. same dang thing. And so I get that. Do you think that, like, when it comes to the public's interest in the environmental issues versus a serial killer, do you think that it's about control? Like, you feel like if you just catch the bad guy, you can stop the terribleness, but you can't stop the fog, they thought.
Yeah, I think it's much easier to be concerned about a clear and present danger like this serial killer who's running around the city and maybe you're the next victim. versus something that is a problem that is requires a systemic change, which is air pollution. I mean,
yeah,
it was
that's no fun.
It's just not. It was, and it's kind of a Debbie Downer, and yeah. It's boring. And it just, I'll tell you, it took a lot of work for me to turn the fog into a boogeyman, but yeah. I really needed to. And it's a good boogeyman, I think.
Yeah. So. And you were successful because it did feel so menacing. And I kept thinking about you as the writer and how I wondered if you felt like you had a fog around you sort of every day while writing it.
I think so. I think that, you know, I work really hard to stay present in the book and, you know, just to continue to stay connected with the characters. In the middle of writing the book, we had some really horrible wildfires, similar, well, much, much smaller than what's happening now in the West, but really about 30 or 40 miles from Austin. And I could step outside my office at the University of Texas and just smell the fumes from 30, 40 miles away. Mm-hmm. And it just constantly brought me back to the feeling that you can't, when you're in a fog, just like in a wildfire, you can't, there's no escape. You know, fumes are not stopped by the front door or closed window. They come in, there's nothing to stop it. So I think, you know, staying really present was helpful. And luckily, I just love creepy things. And so I was really able, I mean, I had candles lit everywhere. I'm sure it looked like a room of sacrifice or something. I was watching really creepy TV series on BBC with the accents. And so I really, it was sort of method acting, except method writing. Something
yeah,
like
that. That makes sense because you really had to portray that, convey that to your reader as well. And you did such a good job in, if I was flying when I read it and I felt, you know how you already feel weird on a plane? Mm-hmm. And I that you were very effective. Let's talk about the gal that you ended up speaking to, Rosemary, who was 13 at the time and had a story to tell about her father in the fog and the tragedy in her family. Here's what I don't get. Because it said in the notes that she was reluctant to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
What's with that?
I know. Well,
I can't relate.
Why? You would. Yeah, I think it could be a British thing. Oh. Hopefully, it doesn't offend any of your British.
My
viewers.
Husband's British. I feel you're right.
Is it a British thing?
Yeah.
You know, her siblings and her mom never talked about it. Literally, I mean, she's 77 now, and they won't talk about it. And I think that the common response I got from the people, you know, there were a lot of people I interviewed that never ended up in the book. They were sort of on background. And it was a very common response was that this was just a fog. It just happened. And then it was over and we had to move on. And I, you know, it's different for Rosemary because she lost her father.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine living with the body of your father in the parlor with the door shut for several weeks and it not affecting you, but we're different. Americans are different. And I think she just didn't want to dig it up, but she had such a remarkable memory about everything. I was really grateful.
Do you think that she has fears now about fog and stuff?
Maybe. I have fears about fog.
Do you?
Well, okay. Not, it's strange. Not about pollution. So for me, the fog was certainly creepy in the sense that, you know, there are all these chemicals entering your body and everything mm-hmm. burns and your nose burns and your throat burns. But the fog to me represents a vulnerability. And I think that that's a big thread throughout the book is, you know, a city that's vulnerable after World War II. People in Notting Hill, where the serial killer lived, who are vulnerable because it's such a horrible area with so many horrible people. And then, you know, this little girl who didn't choose to live in London, didn't choose her father's profession, you know, made no choices about burning coal. And so for me, what fog represents now is a little bit of fear because I have a line in the book that's very true for me, which is, you know, if you're in the fog and you can't see anything, you're surrounded. If you're with your husband or your wife, you can kind of grab onto them and it's romantic, you know, you're safe and it's sort of you two against the world. When you're by yourself, especially in a dangerous city like London was at the time, you become very vulnerable. And so I think every time I feel a fog, I do, or I'm in a fog, which happens when I run sometimes, I do feel a little bit of a uneasiness, but it's still my favorite weather phenomenon.
You're a glutton for punishment. Okay. So let's talk about Christy.
Yes.
Okay. First of all, what's your diagnosis of this guy?
I don't know. I think about that a lot. And I was wondering if you were going to ask that. So here you go. So here's the thing. You can go, you mean diagnosis, like, do I think he's a Looney Tune or do I? Okay. I think anyone who scatters bodies all over his property probably has some problems. But I think my understanding of definition between psychopath and sociopath is the psychopath isn't aware that what he's doing is wrong and therefore doesn't cover it up. And Christy clearly covered up, you know, his crimes, and he planned them very well. So I don't know. I think that it's good he was executed, probably, but it wasn't given the, you know, the opportunity to have an insanity plea. But, you know, I don't know. He just had, he was so interesting because he had what I would think is sort of a stereotypical background for a serial killer. He was a loner. He had a semi-abusive father. He was had an oppressive mother. He had trouble with girls in that department growing up, and he was made fun of. And then on top of that, he was gassed in the First World War. So he has this really squeaky voice. He has a girlish bounce. I mean, the guy just had so many strikes against him. So yeah, he was pretty ticked at the world. And this is just one of the ways that it manifested itself. So I don't know. I think probably not. I think some type of mental illness, but he certainly knew what he was doing. What do you think?
Well, I don't think he felt bad at all. There was no remorse. And so I thought sociopath. Mm-hmm. And I write letters. I'm pen pals, penitentiary pals with the Unabomber and BTK.
What?
Yeah. And I write to them and they write me back and they sound very similar.
Let's forget about my book for a second. So what do they say in these letters?
Well, Unabomber, he was a PhD in mathematics and he still writes a lot and wants to publish books. So when people write to him, if he thinks that you can provide him with a resource, like information about something in academia, then he'll write you back because he sees it like as transactional.
Okay.
So I use him and he uses me because I'm trying to find out information about morality because my PhD is in religious studies.
Oh, right.
And so I wanted to get to the bottom of like, do you think these people just snapped and like are they choosing darkness or what happened in their life anyway? And so he's very seemingly sane. Like he makes a lot of good points and his thing was that he had he had the manifesto. So he had something to say, like a philosophy.
Yeah.
Whereas the BTK one, you remember him?
I do. Bind, torture, kill.
Yeah. Dennis Rader.
Mm-hmm. That was I don't even want to go into how much I know. That's Washington State, I think, right?
I think he was in Topeka, Kansas area.
We'll look it up. Yeah, we'll see. Okay. So what does BTK say?
Well, he sounds more like Christy, and his technique was a little bit more like that, where there was a component of sexual pleasure and also with the choking aspect. So they sound similar. And the stuff he sends is way weirder. Like he draws pictures a lot and like, your face is classic. Anyway, that's enough about me. I'm just saying, like, he sounded so similar, and that's how I classify them, is just sociopathic, where they have no sense of right and wrong. If they do, they don't care.
Well, okay, so I'd be interested in what BTK says about stuff like this. Christy loved animals, loved them, protected them. It broke his heart to put down his old dog. He gave away his cat before he went on the run. So it's so odd. He was very protective of animals, and it was just his little family. Of course, he killed his wife, so part of the family went away. But I think, you know, also another trait would be interesting to find out with the BTK and Unabomber is serial killers a lot of times are very, very creative. you know, photography. Christy was really into photography, art, and you were saying the Unabomber.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that those are all, it's just so interesting to see in a case that's more than 60 years old, that these details come out that are just similar, that, you know, serial killers have been this very similar
yes.
for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So.
Right.
Fascinating.
It really is. And I don't know, even, well, in John Ronson's book about psychopaths, he talks about, though, how often they do really love animals
mm-hmm.
and that they see them as possessions and that they're, you know, it's like if somebody wrecked your car when you lose your dog. It's like that kind of feeling where you're like devastated, but not in the same way that we would feel if we lost someone we loved.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
But I think that that's a common thing, too. Weird, right?
Really weird. There's a, we're getting off topic, but there's an article, I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly, that talks about, you know, my child is a psychopath and how do you identify that? It's so fascinating. I wish
you
I could have
sent me that.
I will. I'll send you that.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Now also, I'm sure that you also keep having to answer this, but I am curious. So I want to know, if you really do think there were two serial killers in that dang house.
No.
Oh, you don't.
No. Do you?
You made me. Well, no, but you made me think you did.
Well, I wasn't. So here's the thing. So I'm a journalist and we're taught to not take a stand. You know, present people's
yeah.
information and they can make their own decision. My issue, I think, with the story with Timothy Evans is, well, I don't think there were two serial killers. No. Okay. Let me rewind. So
yeah.
I do think Timothy Evans was guilty. So you're right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Hold on. You can
be able
to edit that.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
What? Okay. So, so the setup of the story is the Timothy Evans and his wife and child move into the building. The wife and child go missing. He confesses. Then he says, no, I didn't do it. Then he says, yes, I did do it. He's an abusive husband.
Yeah.
He's cheating on his wife. And when they finally track down her body and the little girl's body, he's convicted partially because of John Christie's testimony. And I think that the issue people had at the time was that once we a serial killer, it was hard for people to believe that there would be two killers living in the same building at the same time. Okay,
yeah.
I know, that's odd, but not a serial killer. Two serial killers? Yeah, that's a little bit odd.
You're right.
So, okay, so Notting Hill in the 1950s was a really difficult place. There was a lot of poverty. It was a slum. There was a high unemployment, a lot of alcohol, and a lot of servicemen coming back from the war with guns.
Yeah.
And pretty pissed off with life.
Yeah.
And so a serial killer in a building with another serial killer is pretty out of the question. A serial killer in a building with a husband who was abusive and then snapped.
Yeah.
I, it doesn't surprise me one bit. Nobody can accept that today or 65 years ago. It just seems like too much of a coincidence that they were both in the building at the same time. The problem is they're both liars, and we kind of had a Keystone Cop situation happening where the Metropolitan Police just really didn't do a good job with the investigation. They walked right by a thigh bone holding up a piece of fence when they were searching for this wife and this little girl. I mean, it's just incredible. So there were a lot of missed things. And, so, and again, that speaks to the atmosphere of London at the time, which was a police force that was undermanned, really heavy with crime. And that area was such a bad area. Christie's garden was just wrecked. There was trash everywhere. And of course, two bodies buried, and they walked right over the bodies. They had no idea that these two skeletons were there. So there were a lot of missteps, but I think the issue of just finding out who was guilty and who wasn't in that situation is they were both violent. They were both liars. They both recanted. And, you know, and so I think there's so much confusion over both of their stories. I think the more likely story is that Timothy Evans did kill his wife and little girl. And Christy confessed, but he confessed, I think, primarily, well, I know, because defense attorney wanted to go for an insanity plea. And so he said, more the merrier, you know, put in as many bodies as you can. He tried to get him to confess to a murder in Windsor, where Christy wasn't even in Windsor at the time. So, I mean, it's an admirable, I guess. I don't know. Desperation of an attorney.
This is why people need to read the book, by the way, because there's so many parts that are just like head scratchers, and it's just really fun read, even though it's disturbing. Okay, now, what do you think? See, this is why people end up talking about the murder stuff more than Fog, because like it's not the death as much it is the oddity of it. Like even the tin of pubic hair, come on, what is happening? I kept reading it and thinking, what is going on with that tin? Why was that there?
I thought BTK had a trophy. Didn't he have trophies?
Yeah, but not a tin. I mean, he's not crazy. Not a tin of pubic hair.
Well, and I think the description of when I spoke to Lynn Trevelyan over the phone, the description of that was funny because when I talked to him, he was the police officer who found the tin to begin with. When I talked to him over the phone, he was 101.
No.
So you can imagine how I didn't want to hear a 101-year-old man talk about pubic hair, but it is an important detail. I mean, trophies exist and, you know, people like them. He kept, he snipped his wife's pubic hair also and kept wedding rings, and you know, Timothy Evans kept his wife's wedding ring, and it's just an odd thing. You know, when Christy killed his wife, he put her under the floorboards of the parlor and sort of slept nearby in the bedroom, but he couldn't sleep in the marital bed where he killed her, so he slept on the floor. It was just like the process of what people,
right, where they draw the line.
True, yeah, but I think the 10 and with the pubic hair, and there are pictures out there of it too. I don't think the evidence, I know, longer exists. And then it became, I'll tell you the most fascinating part is when 1950s pathologists were debating whether or not this pubic hair came from which woman. And so I'm reading all these reports and it's like,
of
course this. Yeah. And then they exhumed the body of the wife, Burl Evans, Timothy Evans' wife, and checked the length to see, this is going down a bad road.
I love it though. That's so interesting. And they were seeing if he's
the link. Right. Well, they said that your body will allow your hair to grow, all hair to grow after you die for a certain period. And so it was clear that she had never had her pubic hair clipped. So to the prosecutor proved that none of the pubic hair found in the 10 belonged to Burl Evans. Therefore, Christy didn't kill her. Therefore, you know, they had not prosecuted and hanged the wrong man. So there's the autopsy photos and the pathology reports are startling.
Who
to me.
Knew that tin of pubic hair would come in handy?
I would say it was very handy.
Okay.
I buried it in the garden, though. That was a little odd, but...
Yeah, that's the odd part.
But also, why would you use a thigh bone to prop up a fence also?
Right. Anyway. He made some interesting choices.
He did.
Okay. Now, I have to, keep doing that because there's so many different things. So when you were working in television... You covered the famous Chandra Levy case.
I did, yeah.
Which was fascinating and sort of let, I mean, 9/11 is kind of what made that go away in terms of coverage, because up until that point, that's all that was on television in the evenings. Mm-hmm. Did you think Gary did it at the time?
I did.
Yeah, me too.
I think so too. I can't believe you remember that. Old.
I was into it and I thought he did it for sure. And I'm shocked that he didn't do it.
I am too, because obviously the more... So do you think people know about this case? Chandra Levy?
Yeah.
So she disappeared. I think, so that happened in September of 2001. So she disappeared a few months earlier, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like early in 2001 or something.
Right. And she was an intern for a California congressman named Gary Condit. And he was sort of the king of the castle in Central California.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a agriculture community. So I had to set up shop there for a couple of months.
Modesto,
and,
right?
In Modesto, how that almond capital of the country, I believe. And so I went to Modesto quite a lot when I lived in San Francisco. So Gary was having an affair with his intern who then went missing.
Right.
And so it was right. And then I don't remember if she was actually pregnant, but there were rumors that she was pregnant. And she just walked out the door for a run and never came back. And then, right, it turns into a he clammed up. He was married to a woman who had, I think, brain cancer at the time.
Oh, my God. And lived in
Central California. I think it was brain cancer or tumor. I can't remember. And he lost re-election. He was never charged. He was a suspect, but he wouldn't talk. Nobody would talk about it.
When he was like throwing stuff related to her in dumpsters.
Yeah, she bought him like a watch, I think, yeah. And he lost it. Yeah, it was pretty crazy. So, right, who would think that a serial killer is the one out of all the possible people who would have grabbed her. So she was, I don't remember what the park was, but apparently she was jogging through the park and she got snatched and killed and buried at the park. And I think it was only just a few years ago that they finally found her body, but it ruined his career for sure.
I don't even know what he's doing. Is he just retired or?
I don't know. He must. Yeah, I'm sure he was a very popular, representative. Yeah. He was Miss Senator. So
don't bang your intern.
Well, at least be open about it. If the police come knocking and saying, hey, she's gone. I mean, he just completely shut down and that's what caused the suspicion. But right. I mean, if you're going to choose between random killer who is stalking women in a Washington park versus, you know, the guy who's having an affair, I think he was in his 40s or early 50s and she was 21 or 22, very young at the time. So anyway, it caused a huge scandal. And that was my first, I would say that was a crime story that I really dug my way into. And I really, really enjoyed that story. And it sounds weird. I'm sure you feel the same way about your pen pals. It sounds weird and sort of guilty for me to feel like I do enjoy these stories because they're so lurid and uncomfortable. And sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm getting entertainment out of someone else's sorrow, but man, it really does. All of those stories say something about our society.
Yeah.
And what we value. And again, you know, coming back to the book, why would you be scared? Why are we more interested in a serial killer and even more interested when he's caught? So the clear and present danger is done in March. They've caught him. He's surrendered. And then the trial and the headlines went through the entire summer. I mean, the whole summer. He led the newspapers. Every time a psychiatrist would get on the stand, you know, I mean, there were these full spread front page articles. And it was incredible. And yet the fog is barely in there. It's in the parliamentary notes in the back section of the Times of London.
Wow.
So, but again, you know, this is John Reginald Christie was a pretty extraordinary case because I'm so into true crime. And, you know, I watch Dateline NBC. I watch all of those shows. And so I'm prepared if somebody sneaks up on me pretty well. And it's a practical thing you get out of that is you learn a little self-defense, you know, and what people do wrong. You know, always lock your doors. And so it takes a lot to shock me. And so I'm not interested in anybody who doesn't shock me. And he really did.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he has no relatives like alive?
No, not really. I mean, he had some sisters, no brother. He had some sisters who I think everybody just sort of went away and he was detached from his family completely. So, yeah, he never had children. So,
oh, thank God. All right. You're off the hook. I was wondering if you were the person that found this beautiful photo on the cover.
I did.
No. How psyched were you?
it was great. And I really, and my editor, I think, was drawn to it really, really quickly also. So, and that was taken during the smog. And it was put on a magazine cover in November, I believe, of 1953. So
it's such a gorgeous photo. And it's of course, you know, symbolic in so many ways. I actually was like, is this real or was it, you know, made just for the book? Because it's so appropriate. I love it.
That's one of the things I think about this story, the pictures that first struck me were, you know, seeing these pictures and seeing just sort of people trying to make their way through this fog. And I think that that really is what drew it to me. I'm really into visuals. I can't tell a story unless I can put, you know, the visuals to the page, because I'm just such a, you know, sort of movie documentary television driven person. So it was really appealing to me.
Yeah.
And also serial killer stuff. I mean, those photos are pretty, some of them out there are pretty gnarly, body bags and bones and, you know.
Right. So it's fascinating. It just is.
Yes,
so I hope everybody reads it. Do you have plans for your next move, or are you like, you need a break?
No, no breaks for me. I'm not I know. Yeah, I have another book in the works.
Wow.
And I can't really talk about it. I can't talk about it. But it's not, it is sort of 1870s Gilded Age New York in another Looney Tune, who's probably not a real Looney Tune. Yeah. Genius, except this one's a real genius. Killer. So
wow, I love it.
Well, and that's so nice because you can just drop yourself into an incredibly rich world, especially, you know, 1950s London and Gilded Age New York. And so that's just, I love being in that world and finding out what people ate and the parties and, you know, the good and the bad. So,
wow. Keep up the good work.
Thanks.
My
I appreciate
God.
It.
Fantastic. And you're off the hook. I'll let you know when this posts.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks
I appreciate
so
it. Hey,
much.
I have your email, so I'll send you the link. To the Atlantic. It's a crazy, crazy art. It's great.
Oh my God. Thanks. You're the best.
You're welcome.
Have a great day and congrats again.
Thanks, Susie.
Bye, Kate.
Bye.